But right now I'd like to welcome to our program Tim Sullivan. He's a policy coordinator with the group United for a Fair Economy and co-author of his group's 10th annual Martin Luther King Jr. Holiday Report titled State of the Dream 2013, A Long Way from Home. Tim, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
First of all, tell our listeners a bit about United for a Fair Economy and the history, the decade-long history of this report.
Well, United for a Fair Economy is an education and advocacy organization dedicated to raising awareness about economic inequality and working towards change, building a movement to reduce economic inequality. The report that we released today, the State of the Dream, it is the 10th annual State of the Dream report. It was 40 years after Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech. It's now 50 years since that speech, and we decided that we should look at how we're doing. I think that you mentioned that there tends to be a focus on just sort of the basic racial equality. When people think of Martin Luther King, what they remember of that speech is often about black children and white children, and we wanted to say, well, what's actually happening with our progress towards equality? This particular report, we focused on wealth, and we looked at wealth disparities, which are quite staggering.
Well, thanks for that, Tim, and you know, it's appropriate, and I'm very happy you could join us on today with the marks the anniversary of Dr. King's birth. But maybe you could talk a bit about the state of inequality in the country. Before we get into some of the specifics of the report, actually, maybe you could talk about inequality in the country generally, because certainly since the Great Recession, as it's called, that kicked in late 2007 and has been you know, making a lot of people's lives miserable over the last a bunch of years, we have seen inequality skyrocket. But there's a long trend of inequality in this country, growing inequality for decades before. But maybe just a general overview here.
Yeah, well, generally, what you said gets it right. There's been a pretty dramatic growth in economic inequality, particularly over the last 30 years. It's been a bit longer than that. And there's many reasons why that is the case, from financialization to improvements in technology, as some people would point out. Policy, federal policy, plays a hugely significant role in that as well. Some of the supports that helped build the middle class were taken away. Tax rates have been lowered at the top end, and we've sort of have let loose capital, and the result is that more and more income and wealth is going to already wealthiest 1% of the country. That's been the trend overall, and it really, not just since the Great Recession, but in the run-up to it, which was brought on by a housing bubble and people taking on more and more debt in order to keep their spending up, we saw a dramatic spike in it to levels that we haven't seen since before the Great Depression. Two generations ago, actually, at this point. That's the general overview that we're looking at inequality in this report. And we focused, like I said, on the wealth inequality, which has a lot to do with the Great Recession. What we looked at specifically is how people of color, black and Latino families and white families, how they've fared since the Great Recession. And we found that there's a very disparate racial impact, which has a lot to do with where and how people hold their assets.
Thank you for that, Tim. And maybe you could get into this a little bit more. How does housing figure in prominently with people's loss of their family's net value? What's the link there between housing and the disadvantage a lot of people find themselves in now after the Great Recession?
Right. Well, that's a great question, and that's what was really at the core of this recession that began in 2007 was a housing bubble. Result of that is that this housing bubble burst and housing value declined dramatically. So if for families whose wealth was more connected to their housing than other assets, like, say, the stock market, their wealth declined more. The housing market has not come back the way that the stock market has. And what we found is that people of color, black families and Latino families, and people with lower levels of wealth, more of it is tied to their housing on average. You know, obviously not everybody is a homeowner, but throughout communities, poorer communities have more of their wealth connected to their first home, and when the housing values decreased, more and more people found that they owed more against their house than it was actually worth. They were unable to sell it if they needed to access that money, which is a major problem with having wealth tied to housing to too great a degree, and ended up poorer than they were relative to families who were able to hold assets in stocks and bonds and bank accounts. And like I said, the housing market has not rebounded the same way that the stock market has. So the recovery has been very uneven, and people who hold a lot of stocks, which are wealthier people, have done, relatively speaking, well since the recovery as it is began in around 2010, 2009, I believe, is when the recovery technically began. But it's been very rough for people who need to sell their house or in order to access their wealth need to borrow against their house. It's been very tough for people who aren't homeowners as well. And we have a lot of policy supports for home ownership that has gotten people into a lot of good situations. It has had benefits for individuals, for families and communities, but it also has this drawback of if that's where your wealth is, when the housing market as a whole goes down, you're in some fairly serious trouble.
Tim, what's the relative disparity between blacks, whites, and Latinos when it comes to family net worth?
Well, it's immense is really what it is. We looked at it, there's a lot of different ways to look at it, and every way that you do, it is a overwhelming disparity. So for both black and Latino families, it's about six times, white families on average have about six times as much wealth. And that's the average amount. And if you look at it in terms of the median, and that's the middle of the wealth distribution, it's even greater. I believe it's around 10 to 1 for white families to black families at the median. So it's really just every way that you look at it, it's a staggering, overwhelming disparity.
Now, I'm wondering how the value of housing in a family's investment in housing has links to the issues talked about in the report that include health, education, annual income, and economic security generally. It's a lot to cover, but I wonder, generally speaking, it seems that your report discusses the idea that housing is key to so much more than just the roof over your head.
Oh, that's absolutely the case. Housing and wealth. So for the average family, especially the average black or Latino family, much of the wealth is tied up in their housing. It's also a significant part of white wealth, but it's to a far greater degree important and significant to people of color. So what we see with that is that the wealth of communities of color being tied to housing has, like I said previously, the negative impact of being unable to access that wealth. It's connected to community well-being in a number of ways. And what we found with wealth is that wealth seems to be a larger determinant of so many of the other socioeconomic indicators than other ones.
Okay. And, one of the interesting parts of the report discusses the difference between housing, simply having a shelter and a place to rest your head at night, and building assets, building the wealth of your family. And in the past, the report says, these two policy objectives were combined and not in a very strategic way. Talk about how simple shelter in a family getting adequate housing versus asset building should be separate.
Right. Well, politicians from both parties have said that it's important that we, you know, help families build wealth, and there's been an overarching goal of federal policy that we should encourage home ownership. It is true that home ownership does have a lot of benefit. and is a way for people to build wealth. And I think that, that taking that basic point and making it into then we're going to direct all of our policy towards wealth creation and housing policy as the same thing is sort of what has happened because both parties can agree on it. The biggest way that we do that is through the tax code, actually. We subsidize home ownership, particularly with the home mortgage interest deduction. And the benefit of that obviously goes, therefore, to people who can afford to purchase homes. It's a tax deduction that goes to homeowners. And not just owning home, you have to have money borrowed against your home to have the benefit of that. So it encourages both home ownership and borrowing against the house. And we should be looking at other asset-building policies. The federal government does engage in other types of asset-building policy, particularly around business creation. And we think that what we should be doing is actually targeting the asset-building policy at the people who need help the most, not people necessarily who are in the upper end of the income distribution and can afford to purchase a home and have the credit to borrow against it, but the people who genuinely need help more than people who are in that good of a financial position. So we recommend baby bonds, which are a way to get assets into the hands of people as they're becoming entering adulthood at the age of 18. And we recommend encouraging cooperative business development, which helps with people who have a bit less access to capital, able to pool their capital and start businesses and encourages entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I'd like to talk more about that in a moment. And just to reintroduce you to our audience, this is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, and we're talking this evening with Tim Sullivan, policy coordinator with the group United for a Fair Economy. We're talking about the group's 10th annual Martin Luther King Jr. holiday report titled State of the Dream 2013, A Long Way from Home. And Tim, tell us a little bit about housing policy in the country. It's emphasized in the report that housing really should be a human right. But is it recognized as so in the United States, given that a lot of support for public housing has disappeared in recent decades? And what is being done to ensure that, you know, people who are down on their luck, you know, at least have a place to sleep and a secure and safe place to sleep?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. It used to be a major focus of federal housing policy and has become less and less so. So federal support for public housing should absolutely be increased with recognition that what we need to be doing with our housing policy is providing housing, letting people have a home. And when we talk about issues of economic inequality, the disparity between millions and millions of Americans who are homeless and, you know, people who have multiple homes couldn't be more clear. We need to make sure that everybody not just has a roof over their head, but has a safe, secure, and accessible place that they can call home. That should be the goal of what we're doing with housing policy. That it does have benefits as home ownership is important, but not everybody can be a homeowner. Not everybody should be a homeowner. If you, for example, just if you intend to move within the next couple of years, you shouldn't probably be purchasing a home because it will cost you more money with debt service and transaction fees and all of that. So policies aimed at home ownership miss people. It's not even necessarily a question of how well off you are, but people who it just might not be the best option for, whether or not they can afford it. So yeah, absolutely, public housing is one important thing. A lot of housing policy happens at the state level as well. In the report, we have a couple of recommendations or highlight a couple of success stories with state laws. And so there should be some more focus on what's happening at the state level. The federal government does do some granting out to the states for housing policy. And again, that should really be aimed at making sure that it's affordable, accessible, safe, and that everybody has a house. A home, I should say. Apartments are good as well because somewhere in the neighborhood of a third of the population are renters, and we shouldn't ignore them at the expense of encouraging home ownership for everybody else.
Tim, maybe you can speak to the relative strength of policies like Section 8 housing subsidies. And we also, of course, in recent decades, we saw public support fall away for public housing. in that a lot of the public housing projects around the country were poorly maintained. They were crime-ridden. They were giant complexes, you know, with 20 floors sometimes. And eyesore people in cities and towns didn't like the way that worked out. And the people who lived there didn't like it much either. Are there some good alternatives to that kind of housing policy?
Yeah, well, I think that there's some merit to the Section 8 program. It's done a little bit differently than I think would be ideal. It's a sort of credit to the landlord, which the sort of specifics of how the policy works, it does some good. It gets a lot of people into housing that they wouldn't be able to get into. In terms of sort of how public housing is built now, a lot less of it is I think the first and most important point. We're not putting up, like you said, these giant towers of public housing. A part of that has to do with, you know, that they weren't in that form always the most successful way to go. And I think that that's an important thing to keep in mind, but it's also important to remember that housing is very much a local issue, and it depends on the community. In New York City, for example, it might make sense to put up a tower and have that be actual public housing. In a smaller community, you might not want to make it quite so dense. It has to work with the community that it exists in.
Right. Well, Tim, at the conclusion of the State of the Dream 2013 report, you make some recommendations about policy changes, and maybe you can first talk about how the Obama administration in the first 4 years has worked on policy, how well they've worked on housing policy, and what you would advocate for changes going forward over the next 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of housing policy, I think that it's on this, the second inauguration day for Barack Obama, it's been very disappointing. The Obama administration came into office really when the housing crisis was going from beginning to full-scale epic disaster, and it really was. The level of foreclosures, the number of people losing their homes, was staggering, and the programs that they put in place were frankly insufficient. And additionally, there was banks and lending institutions that were engaged in what frankly was illegal activity, and the prosecution of those has been fairly weak. There have been some settlements that have come out about faulty document filing practices, and people who lost their homes, who were foreclosed, who shouldn't have been, who should have had opportunities to save their home. And the settlements, like I said, have been fairly disappointing. We highlight there's a lot of groups around the country that are working very effectively on those issues at the local level, on the ground, and fighting foreclosure. We highlight one of them that's up here in Boston, City Life Vita Urbana, who are really provided kind of a model for the country of blockading and preventing foreclosure and following through the legal process towards systemic change as well. And they're more than at the federal policy level, those local actions and, again, education, organizing, make a real difference for real families. And in terms of housing, it's a complex mix of various federal laws and state laws and local laws. We focus really on the tax expenditures related to housing more than anything else. At United for a Fair Economy, we have worked on taxes since our founding in the 90s, and there's a huge benefit for home ownership and in the tax code, and the distribution where that benefit goes to is not where we think it should be going to as it pertains to housing policy in particular.
Well, thank you, Tim. You know, in closing, maybe you could say a word more about cooperative business arrangements, both in terms of housing, but also in terms of entrepreneurship and ways that people can get ahead in this economic system without having, you know, someone with a lot of money waiting in the wings or going to banks, which may not be so happy to be lending to someone without a lot of, assets
right,
that they can put on the line.
Yeah, no, it's one of the major barriers to ownership is not having something to borrow against to leverage to get more. With cooperatives, there's a distinct advantage in that individuals and communities are able to pool their assets as worker owners of a cooperative business or in housing, a different sort of ownership structure that makes it community ownership rather than exclusively individual ownership. And it has a lot of advantages, cooperatives do. We use federal law to encourage cooperative developments in rural communities already. Some of the sort of the farm cooperatives and that sort of thing, that's already a part of federal law. And we think that it should be expanded to include urban communities. Again, there's examples where that has been tried and worked extremely successfully in Cleveland, Ohio, and Austin, Texas, and elsewhere throughout the country. And we think that it should be expanded further. We think that it gives access to a broader range of people. And there's a number of benefits of cooperative businesses as well, including generally higher wages and better working conditions because the workers are actually the owners of the organization, of the company.
I know in housing, too, that there are all these new models of cooperative housing where sort of intentional communities develop around pooling their resources to purchase a place to live together, and it's more than just a sort of the traditional condo association. There's a lot more cohesion in the group of people that do get together to launch these projects.
That's right. That's right.
And I know there's one up in Boston, and a friend of mine works in Jamaica Plain. But they're all over the country now, and it's growing. So
It is indeed, and we think that it's growing because it's successful, and we think that when there's a successful model like that that can provide greater equity and a better share of equity, that we should pursue it with policy. And it would not be too difficult to do that at the federal level with cooperative development.
Well, Tim, thanks so much for spending time with us on this Martin Luther King Day holiday to talk about your group's new report, State of the Dream 2013, A Long Way from Home. Tell our listeners how they can get themselves a copy of the report on your website.
If you go to www.faireconomy.org/dream, faireconomy.org/dream, you can download the full report there.
Okay, so that faireconomy.org just
clicked
right.
Off
yeah, there
no,
for a second.
Thank you very much. And, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Tim. Take care, and thanks for the report. Bye-bye. That was Tim Sullivan, policy coordinator with United for a Fair Economy. Again, their website, faireconomy.org/dream, if you want to get a copy of the report. He's co-author of the report, State of the Dream 2013, A Long Way from Home.